Welcome to Pieces of Choice, the podcast where we explore how conscious awareness can help us cultivate inner peace and transform our lives. In this episode, I'm so pleased to be joined by Matt Phelan, co-founder of the Happiness Index, a platform dedicated to measuring employee engagement and well-being, but with a focus on cultivating employee happiness using a progressive and unique approach. A former digital marketing agency owner, Matt is also a sought-after speaker on happiness, organisational culture and employee well-being, and also a long-standing friend of mine. Matt is passionate about creating positive change in the workplace, making him the perfect guest for today's conversation. We'll be discussing the link between employee happiness and peace, probably not a topic of conversation that you cover much, Matt.
Well, thanks for having us on, Natasha. Until you invited me on, it's not something I'd thought about too much, but then the more and closer we've got to recording this, I thought, wow, I can't believe we haven't really got into this before. So yeah, I'm really looking forward to this today.
Well, and as am I. And I was trying to remember the other day how we met. I actually have no recollection of it. Can you remember how we met?
Yes, I can. It was at your book launch.
How did you end up at my book launch?
I don't know. I think a shared person between us both is someone that you've done some work with recently, which is Louise Lawrence. So Louise and I go back to when we were 17 or 18 years old. So I think possibly Louise invited me. That's either that or I gatecrashed it, one or the other.
And I think that was about 6 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah. Time flies, doesn't it? That was before the pandemic.
Exactly. Doesn't it just? Well, thank you so much for being here today. And we started this conversation briefly over brunch a couple of weeks ago, where you said that because you were coming on the podcast, you'd given a bit more thought to peace. So actually, why don't we start there? What thoughts were sparked knowing that we would be talking today?
Well, the first thing, I've gone on to do a little bit more research on the subject, but the first thing is, if I think about it myself personally, I think the only time I'm at 100% peace is when I'm playing football myself. I think peace isn't something I seek, even though I'm more interested in it now. I know that it's something you're looking at. The adventure is probably the thing that I seek the most, which doesn't always collaborate well with peace. So yeah, but even since knowing that I was coming on, I've noticed that when I do reach moments that are peaceful, quite often I'll interrupt it myself by going and doing something. But even since we've chatted since brunch, I started to think when I do reach those moments, actually, I just need to sit with it and be in it. Because it is a really nice feeling when you feel peace. But it's not something I'd consciously thought about until our conversation.
Well, so I'd really like to take a moment to explore the link between happiness and peace. So if we maybe go right back to when you started the Happiness Index and what led to that in the first place.
So it's probably the opposite of peace, which was we were young, we were in our 20s and we were growing a business and it was growing fast and we didn't really know what we were doing and things started to go wrong. Like our employees were stressed. Our customer service wasn't as high as it needed to be. And we sort of found this thing called employee engagement. And we're quite data driven and we sort of looked into it and thought that doesn't really do what we're trying to achieve, which is really get under the hood of what's causing the problem. And that's where we started down the road towards the Happiness Index. So yeah, I think we got into the area of measuring this because we could see that people were unhappy. And that was employees and customers. And we thought, right, this is something we need to fix. So that was as basic as our early thoughts got.
Yeah, okay. And what was leading to unhappiness at the time?
Well, I think now we've gone into it and we've looked at what employees need. If we weren't good managers and we weren't good leaders, we had a vision, we knew the market, we knew the products that we needed to build, but we didn't know what people needed. And I think the first time people lead, they tend to lead and offer what they need. I think we've all made that mistake. So like if you're someone that likes energy, you try to give energy. If you're someone that tries to give clarity, you give clarity. But I think over time, you learn that it's about finding out what makes that person tick. So a classic example in the top drivers of happiness and engagement is clarity. I don't think we were giving people enough clarity on what their role was, as an example, because we were growing fast. We were onboarding lots of people. I don't think we were taking enough time to onboard people. So when you go round the room of what you need, we were probably getting like half of the things right, and we were probably getting about half wrong. So if I speak to people from that era, they loved working there and they have a positive experience, most of them. But we just wanted to do it better. We didn't just want to be like everyone else. We wanted to make it one of our differentiators. So we focused on it.
And I know that you have gone on to do that at the Happiness Index. And I might not pronounce this right, but is it Quokka?
Yes, Quokka. Yeah.
So tell us a bit about that.
So that is the only thing we say at the Happiness Index. This is not data-driven. So people started calling us the indexes, and we just thought, oh, we don't want to be called the indexes. You know, it's like when you get a nickname that you don't want. And we were just like, that doesn't sound, that we didn't feel like that was like, it feels like really sterile, the indexes. And we're supposed to be about emotions and feelings and all that sort of stuff. So we were just on the train and on the way back from our all company AGM, and we were just Googling the happiest animals in the world, and up came a quokka. And we didn't even know what a quokka was. And for those that don't know, it's a marsupial that lives on an island that's got a horrible name, Rottnest Island, but it's a beautiful island just off Perth. They only exist on that island in the wild. And yeah, that became our thing. And even our new AI is called Quokka AI. So if you work at the Happiness Index, we call each other quokkas, which anyone listening probably thinks are absolutely nuts. But that's what we call each other, quokkas.
Well, and I'm also going to say you need to now Google a quokka, because haven't they got those really funny, toothy, smiley faces?
Yeah, and that's what people love them. Like, if you there's one with Kylie Minogue. Like, you can pretty much find a quokka of pretty much every famous Australian having a selfie with a quokka. It's a rite of passage for an Australian celebrity. But yeah, that's what we call each other.
And I mean, so if you go from where you were then, which was our people aren't as happy as we want them to be, and now where you're actually working in a business that is all about driving happiness, what have you learned about what leads to happiness?
Well, the first thing I've learned, and I think we knew this already, but you can't make someone else happy. You can't make your team happy. You can't make your wife happy. You can't make your children happy. You can't make your colleagues happy. However, that doesn't mean you shouldn't try. And the way that we've sort of reframed it for ourselves is, if you think of culture like the soil and the environment that a plant grows in, what you can do is understand those ingredients and provide them. That still doesn't mean someone's going to be happy, because that's a two-way street. Like, if anyone is in a relationship now where they're unhappy, it may be their partner's doing, there may be some toxic stuff happening in that relationship, but there's two parts of it. And it's the same at work. All you can do as a leader is create the right environment. And that we've now gone on to learn, and sure, we'll talk about that now, like what does drive it. But then sometimes when that's what gets thrown back, is it, well, you can't make people happy. And so we say, well, no, we know you can't, but it doesn't mean you can't work or create an environment where people can be happy. Just in the same way that if you were a gardener or a farmer, not all of your crops are going to grow and there's going to be problems, but it doesn't mean you shouldn't be aware of like what is the right soil, what is the right place to put the plant, what ingredients may it need. That's still being a good farmer, and being a good leader is understanding what that is. The complication is, just like plants, there's lots of very different varieties. So there's the universal things that make us tick, but then every individual has different things, and every individual changes over time. Like, what I wanted and what made me happy when I wasn't a parent is different now. So it's in flux, but it doesn't mean you shouldn't try.
And you say that a significant contributor to happiness is clarity. And in the conscious leadership model that I developed, I call that purpose. So working in a purposeful way and focusing on the things that matter most and making sure everybody knows what they're there to do and why they're there to do it. But what else? What are the other contributing factors to happiness?
So for the listener, I'll just define what the difference between what we mean by happiness and engagement. So engagement was coined by Bill Kahn in 1990. I've done a podcast with Bill. I've interviewed him. He's the guy that's invented the thing that has become the thing that he doesn't like. He's like the guy in Jurassic Park that starts off the idea and then totally regrets it. And Bill's vision of engagement is that it was always like this emotional understanding of the workforce. But his belief is it's become this kind of, again, this like sterile management metric that doesn't really do what you need to do. And so to answer your question, we see engagement as what your brain needs at work and happiness is what your heart needs. We would define both purpose and clarity as part of engagement. And our neuroscience shows they're both things the brain that need. So they are actually what we are seeking on a regular basis. So the top four drivers of engagement in our model and our data is purpose, clarity, personal growth, and enablement. The top four drivers of happiness are safety, relationships, freedom, and acknowledgement. And the reason we separate them out is the different areas of the brain and the different brain types. So purpose and clarity sit right next to each other in our model. The only difference is, so the clarity piece is part of the rational part of the brain, whereas purpose is more of the reflective part of the brain. So although that is a micro differentiation, they are, in our opinion, important to separate out slightly. Often purpose gets mixed up with happiness in our model because people, weirdly, they think of, not weirdly, lots of people do, and maybe I did in the past, they think of happiness as the fluffy bit. But the reason purpose sits in the engagement bit for us is because actually what your brain needs is linked to direction and, as you say, clarity. But sometimes purpose gets bracketed in the happiness bit because people just bucket it, them both as the fluffy bit. But actually purpose sits within the brain part that we call engagement.
Great. And what else? What else is important? Because you say that, you know, the heart is as important as the head. So yeah. When it comes to leading, what does that mean on a day-to-day basis?
I think a means on a day-to-day basis is accepting that how your employees feel can be different to how your people think. And that scares people and it confuses some leaders because they want everything to be black and white. They want everything to be very data-driven, and we're a company that believes in data-driven. But what that means is understanding that as human beings, we're quite complex. And this happens all the time when someone leaves a job or they leave their partner and their friends say, oh, you're crazy. Like, why have you left that job? This great location, good salary, all these things. And when someone leaves their partner or they don't speak to someone anymore and their friends think rationally, well, that doesn't make sense. But we're emotional beings and we're driven from our emotions and we can't always explain them. We can't always understand them. And as a leader, being able to be comfortable with that is a big thing, I think, because we like to think of businesses and organizations like robots and factories, whereas the reality is we're more like nature and ecosystems. And to run and nurture an ecosystem is a lot harder than it is to run a factory, because in a factory, you just pull in and out bits and pieces and change this and change that. An ecosystem has huge implications on the interplay between the parts.
That is so interesting. And what I've just jumped to in my mind is performance management, which is not something I thought I was going to be talking to you about today. But performance management being the regular check-ins or development conversations that managers have with their people on a hopefully regular basis. And I think often managers end up having sort of quite transactional conversations around, you know, what are you working on at the moment? What are your priorities? What do you need to get done? You know, what are your blockers? You know, that would be a good quality question if it was asked. Have you got the tools and resources you need, etc.? Or from a developmental perspective, they might be saying, right, you know, what skills do you need to work on? Where do you want to get to in your career? What training do you need to get there? But actually, it sounds like there's a whole heap of heart-related conversation that's required either when it comes to performance or development, and that maybe it's the lack of heart that has led to performance management being quite an unsatisfactory process for many people and in many organisations.
Yeah, I think, again, it goes back to the sort of like factory view that we're robots. And actually, the happiness index should be really renamed the engagement and happiness index. The reason we called it the happiness index is because we thought it was going to be all about happiness, but it's not. You need both sides. And I would guess from what I can see in our data, performance management is the same. You need the heart bit and you need the brain bit. And the magic happens when you connect both. So there's loads of stuff in performance management that is right, but we would say from our data, it's just out of balance, it's out of kilter. And it's just about re-establishing that balance. Like, all my family's are Irish. When you go to Ireland, like, there's a great question that you get asked, which is, it always makes me laugh because we don't ask it in England. But people just say to you, how's the fall?
How's the fall?
Yeah.
It's quite a sports related. But if you're here every day, everyone says, how are you? It's such a generic question that you don't even really consciously think about it. But if someone just changes the question they ask you, like, how's the form? Or, yeah, and they've tried in this country, and now, how are you? How are you really? But sometimes just changing it up so it's not the generic question that you ask all the time. And I imagine in Ireland, how's the form? Probably generic as well. But again, over there, as someone who grew up in England, when someone says, oh, how's the form? It really makes me think, it's like, how is my form? So I think all of those things, that's what leadership and management's about, isn't it? It's like really getting into the team and trying to understand, like, what is going on.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And actually, I mean, you talked about psychological safety as one of the drivers for happiness. And, you know, I talk a lot about psychological safety, but I also talk about managing the nervous system of your team, because the team that's in fight-flight mode is not going to be sustaining high levels of performance. But a team who's feeling calm and, you know, at peace will probably be much more likely to be delivering consistent, sustainable high levels of performance. What does the data say around psychological safety and why it's so important?
Well, I think we should quote, I was very, very lucky last week to get to meet Amy Edmondson, who actually coined that phrase originally. So for me, it's like meeting my hero. And so what we always say in our data, it's not the number one driver. Relationships is the number one driver of happiness. However, I would always say it is the place to start, because all of the other stuff can't happen until you feel safe. And even if you think it on a basic level where someone's looking for another job, like, I don't see it as a bad thing if my team are looking for a job, but it does mean that they're not thinking about, like, what the problem is that you're trying to solve. So that's why all these things, like, you take, like, in clarity was like personal growth. If you can't answer those questions for your team members, and that comes up the lowest quite regularly in companies, personal growth challenges, if you can't answer that, someone else will. So I think the thing that Amy was really stressing in her talk last week was, I don't know if you've seen this at all, Natasha, but she feels a bit like I was saying how Bill Carnes is the person who invented the thing and it's become something else that it shouldn't. She was actually talking about how people weaponize psychological safety and have made it something that it's not. And she actually put a slide up on what it's not, which I found really useful, because what she was saying is you often see people quote someone who's challenged them and say, oh, this person has challenged me, they don't make me feel psychologically safe. She was saying the whole point of psychological safety is that people can challenge each other and they can be comfortable to have really tough, robust questions. And she even went as far to say that job safety is not psychological safety, which is one that comes up. So I'll read out her list that she had up. So she had the top five things that psychological safety is not, which is being nice, which I thought was an interesting one. We've done a podcast recently on the difference between being nice and being kind. For me, the definition is if you've got food on your face, someone being kind will tell you, someone being nice won't, because they think, oh God, you'll be embarrassed. And she used feedback as an example of being nice. You might not give someone some feedback they need because you want to be nice, whereas being kind is that you give them that feedback so they can improve. And psychological safety is not feeling comfortable. Psychological safety is not a guarantee that your ideas will prevail. I think we see that a lot in organizations, that someone gives an idea and it's not accepted, and then they say, oh, I don't feel safe now. Job security, that was controversial in the room, especially the amount of redundancies that are going on at the moment. And point five she had is at odds with high standards, which I took as the main point, that allowing people to be safe, because you hear it all the time, and you hear it in sport a lot, where someone says, well, we need to keep people on their toes. But we do really need to keep people on their toes, because that doesn't sound like a great idea.
Yeah, I mean, that's so, of the so many things going on in my head. In fact, I remember in Amy's book, The Fearless Organization, there was a 2x2 matrix in there. And I can remember when I read it, I was surprised. Well, not surprised, but it was interesting to see that high standards was in that matrix. So psychologically safe environments are driving for high standards, but they are creating an environment where people feel like they can achieve them. it's not about mediocrity or letting people away with things. And often it is about pushing and challenge and people actually are feeling like they're being pushed out of their comfort zone. So I think that is really interesting because it sort of feels a little bit counterintuitive, doesn't it? If I feel safe, actually, I feel comfortable. Well, that's not necessarily the case.
Yeah, and it's really weird that people see accountability and psychological safety as in almost like in conflict with each other. Because I've heard people say that. So yeah, well, people need to be accountable around here. It's like, yeah, I mean, but that's part of clarity. That's absolutely right. You should be setting goals, reevaluating the goals, et cetera, et cetera. But it doesn't, the two must exist together. Like psychological safety leads to high performance. They're not in conflict.
Yeah, absolutely. But it's also interesting what you say about nice and kind, because I work with leadership teams and executive teams to help them to achieve the highest levels of performance for them as a team. Because often when I'm brought into a team or asked to come into work with a team, they're not working as a team. They're a group of very successful P&L owners or operational business owners who work quite independently of each other. And there's often one of two things going on. One is they're simply not a team, so they don't have the relationships. So that puts back to your point about what actually leads to good outcomes is good relationships. Or they're just too nice. They're not challenging each other. They don't feel safe. And often that is underpinned by some real deep insecurities in the team. So either it's being created by the leadership, the most senior leadership, or you've just got insecure people in the team who find it difficult to be challenged. And those things need to be tackled, because you're right. Unless you can have very honest and robust conversations with each other and, you know, radical candor where you're direct but caring seems like a good model for that, then actually you're not going to achieve high levels of performance because you couldn't. You can't break through the barriers or the blockers that are getting in the way of the optimal performance if you're not able to speak to it.
Yeah, absolutely.
So let's talk a little bit more about you, Matt, because there's been key moments in my life over the last few years where I've had a conversation with you, normally during some sort of critical inflection point in my life or where I'm feeling a bit rubbish, and you always make me feel better. So I would class you as a calm leader or somebody who certainly creates a level of calm. Now, and you've got huge amounts of energy and you always seem very sort of energized. So I'm not necessarily saying you sort of walk around quietly or, you know, it's like you bestow wisdom upon other people. And certainly it's my experience that just leads to greater levels of clarity, but also a greater level of calm. Firstly, do you see yourself as that person?
I don't know. I don't know is the honest answer. I'm feeling the pressure now that next time there's a situation that I will make you feel better and not worse. I think I'm very aware of my energy. And again, I have to give a lot of credit to Clive Hyland, who's our head of neuroscience. And he's been my coach for a long time. And he coaches us on the natural rhythms of life and of surge and recovery is a session that he does. So I'm very conscious of that. So if I'm coming to something like this or I'm going to a brunch, I make sure that I've set up the week or my day to make sure that I am at the right state to be there. A really boring example would be, I always make sure that I've been for a run the morning of a board meeting, because it just clears out any stress I've got, any other stuff that's going on in my life. And then I can turn up to be the best I can in that board meeting. Whereas some people might not connect the two. I've even had examples where someone's arrived on time for a meeting and they've got to my office and I've gone down and I said to them, do you mind if we start 5 minutes late? Because I actually just need to go for a walk, because I am monitoring my energy all the time. So I seek solace as well. So there's time when I will recognize that my energy is dipping, but I will seek time on my own. Even though I do work hard, people say they've never been for a lunch break. I've always, always had lunch on my own, and I've always, always made time to go for a little walk on my own, because I know that my afternoon is just nowhere near as productive. So, and even just like little boring things, like when I go on holiday, I don't take my phone with me. When it's the weekend, I turn my phone off. So
I'm conscious of what Clive calls surge and recovery, so that when you see me, I've made sure that when I'm going to an event or whatever, I'm turning up in the right shape. And if I'm not, I would probably like switch it or cancel it or something if I don't feel like I can be a positive force in that, whatever that situation is.
What would happen if you didn't take that space and get your energy on track? How would you show up instead?
I think all the things that we all have, I'd be more irritable, probably wouldn't be as good at listening, less calm. Calm's probably a good one. Like, I'm conscious of all those things. I think the other one, if you're turning up for a board meeting and you're not, I haven't looked after myself, maybe I haven't eaten correctly, haven't done the right exercise, I might take things personally. A classic would be someone brings up the number that you're responsible for in a leadership meeting. If you're not in a calm, good state, you might think, oh, that person's bringing that up because they want to like challenge me. Whereas you realize if you're psychologically safe and you're in your own good state, you realize, okay, that's a board person who's here. They respect me. I respect them. What we're going to do is challenge the number and how we could do it. And we're going to have a good conversation. But we're all humans, aren't we? Anyone who's not had enough sleep knows this. Like, when you get back, you're not as good as you'd be. And I'm sure every single person has had a relationship situation where they've had to apologize and said, you know what, I really wasn't myself then. Sorry that I was really irritable. So it's just applying all of that stuff into thinking about your own performance. That's what I think about all the time. I want to perform as a leader. And to perform as a leader, I need to be in the right state.
What motivates you to want to perform as a leader?
I don't know. I think growing up, like, my parents didn't have money. We didn't have like the usual things that my kids take for granted, like being able to buy us football boots and things like that. So I think I've always wanted to not have to worry about money and things like that. So it's a driver from that perspective. But it's not the driver, because I could leave the Happiness Index tomorrow and join like a big American tech company and earn more money than I do. So I'm definitely driven by trying to improve the way the world works and how people treat each other, because I just hate it when you see people and they're down and their work is crushing them. I see it a lot. And this is one of the saddest things about what I do, is if I could publish a book on the inbox of my LinkedIn, because I post regularly, people message me their life story quite regularly about like the issues they're facing at work. Not because they think I'm an agony aunt or anything like that, but sadly, I always think because they haven't got anyone else to send that to. They're sending it to a stranger who they know is motivated at changing this. You just see it and you just think, it doesn't have to be like this. There's real basic stuff here that's just not being done in the right way that could easily be fixed. So I think at a basic human level, I want to make sure I can provide for my family, and that is important to me. I'm not going to sit here and say I'm not money motivated, but it has to be the other flip of it. Like, my brain wants the money of running successful businesses, but my heart thinks, you know what, there's a better way. And I get so much energy when you work with a customer and their culture improves, because you see it. Like, sometimes we're working with companies of 100,000 employees, you can see the impact that the work is having, and that's pretty cool.
So talk a little bit about that then, because I'm sure that people will want to hear about what you actually do to make that positive difference. So where you have had a positive influence on an organization, what are some of the changes that you're seeing them making?
Well, I think the issue is, like, what makes our job so hard is I effectively spend my day telling people stuff that they don't really want to know or hear. So it creates a real commercial challenge as an organization, because if you think about the Happiness Index at its core, it's neuroscientifically based surveys. But if you really think about what we do, we basically hold a mirror up to what's happening in an organization. And the higher you are up in an organization, the more filtered your view is. No matter how chilled out open door policy you think you are as CEO, your view is filtered and it is protected by the people around you. You're only going to see a certain part of it. So that creates a challenge, because you are showing something that someone hasn't seen before, and quite often what you're showing them is quite challenging. And where it works is where you can show that a leader or a leadership team that this is not a threat, this is an opportunity to learn, it's an opportunity to improve, and it's going to improve the performance of this organization. However, all of us, including me and you, Natasha, we have egos. And sometimes when you show people, very senior, successful people, stuff that they don't want to hear,
it can create very interesting dynamics. And I had one this morning where I can see a leader is so focused on the NPS that they've made it. So for those that don't know, that's an employee net promoter score. It's an important metric. It's measured in the happiness index, but it's not what we would call engagement. Some of the biggest platforms in the world say they're an engagement index, but what they're actually tracking is the NPS. And I'm not here to discredit NPS, but the problem with all these metrics is if you make a metric a target, it becomes self-defeating. And this particular leader is so obsessed with NPS, an extremely high level of NPS score. What I had to say to him is, if you keep this focus up in this particular way, you are going to get a high score. But you are not going to get a high score because of the right reasons. You're going to get it because your team is going to make it happen. That's like the gas engineer who came round and said to me after I had the service of my boiler done, he said, by the way, 10 means good, 9 means, oh, 9 is bad, because it was like a 1 to 10 ring. So he knows how it works. He's playing the game. And as a social human, like all of us, I did put a 10, but that CEO is going to get that outcome, but it doesn't mean it's going to improve the culture. So we live in this complex world where we're in the world of data and insight, where everyone says that they're data-driven, but they're not always as much as they think they are. And the minute it's data that they don't want to hear, it creates a challenge, basically, which I never realized when we started a technology company that it was the human bit that we spend most of our time on, but guess what it is?
Yeah, absolutely. So it sounds from what you've just said that the first thing is that the leadership team needs to be open to hearing it and open to making the changes happen in the first place.
Yeah. And I don't know much about employee-owned organizations, but we recorded a webinar yesterday with the employee-owned businesses, and there was an employee-owned business on there called Blue Flame, which is one of our customers, and they have engineers all around the place that are actually, ironically, going out and doing boilers. But that CEO, we were asking about him, his data, and his data is worse this year than it was last year. And he's looking at that as a positive because he's going, well, brilliant. We've got some information that we can deal with. Whereas some people might go, oh, the scores are lower. This is terrible. Who should we fire? So when you get leadership teams that lean into it and go, brilliant, this is information that we can improve, then it's great. If you get people that are just using the metric because it's another thing in the board pack that they've got to get to go up, then it just becomes lip service.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I've had situations where I've gone in, because often I do discovery work in organisations around either culture or leadership team, and I've shared the information, and it's been sort of pushed underground, and it's hard. I think it's difficult working in the arena that we work in. We are orientated to make positive change happen. And often we have lots of data and also advice and potential solutions that could fix it. But as you say, ego does get in the way. Yeah. So if we end up talking a little bit more about peace, do you think ultimately helps people to find peace? And we talked about the fact that, you know, you only really ever find true peace when you're playing football, and we talked about hobbies when we were approached as a group. But do you think that's the answer? That do you think everybody needs a hobby, or do you think it's more sophisticated than that?
So I'm going to come back to flow in a second and state of flow. There's one other point I just want to reconnect with the last question with this, which is Professor Alex Edmonds from LSE did a great talk recently. He's got an amazing book out. Go and check it out. I think it's called something like Lies. But it's about the lies that data tells. And he basically explains that when you show someone information or data that they don't believe in, hormones in their body get sent around that make them feel bad. And then when you show some data that confirms what they already know, hormones go out in their body that make them feel good. So to link that point in, that's the challenge that you and me face. And I know you've had it with, we have it in the new business cycle here as well. I had had a call this morning with someone, and our team had done a discovery meeting. I wasn't there. I listened to the notes. And then I had to call the HR director because I said, if we tell you what we believe to be true, we've got no chance of working together, because everyone there in the senior leadership team is going to think we're troublemakers and try and chuck us out. So where I'm going with this is
I think one of the issues with achieving peace at home and at work is people like to see things as black and white and right and wrong. And we've learned that through different things from our parents, through religion and all these different influences that we have on our lives. Whereas I think where you get into flow is sometimes it's just the way things are. And then the exciting bit is how like you can unpick that and work on it. But for me, it's an acceptance of where it is. Like, we're only here now. Everyone's in this second right now. This is where we are. And then the exciting bit is how you can move forward from that. But I think for me, peace is just acceptance of living in the now of this is exactly where we are. Like, we might want to be here or we might want to be there or we wish the numbers were like this or wish they weren't. But they're not. That is where we are now. We have to make peace with that. And once you have peace, then you can like plot forward. But I think a lot of people, they will never have peace with the numbers or what's going on in their life because there'll be an issue that they can't get through or that they keep going back to. So I'm just trying to link up the work with your point. And that's where we talk about flow in our neuroscience as well and why hobbies and sport are so important for me because that is the only moment where I am in the now. Like the only thing that is matters, am I chasing the football and so on. But I know that that's different for everyone else. And I think it doesn't have to be a hobby, but I think this is where work can't be that robotic thing. There has to be a way that you can find peace and center yourself and all these things in a normal day that is chaotic. So it's a staging post for moving forward peace. And personally, I wouldn't want to be in peace all the time, but I know there's people like there's Buddhists and there's monks that go out there and they seek that. But personally, I want to find more of it, but I also like chaos as well.
Yeah, okay, well, that's good to know. And of course, we're all unique and we're all configured in different ways. And so the answers are different for all of us. But also, do you think it's also to do with courage? I mean, people often ask me about the journey I've been on and the inner work I've had to do in order to find peace, which is ultimately that, you know, peace has stemmed from a journey of conscious awakening and understanding myself and having to dig around in some difficult old stuff and do what they class as the shadow work. But it does take quite a lot of courage. And going back to the point about when you go into an organization and you tell them some truths that are sort of difficult to stomach sometimes, I think that it does require some real leadership courage to say, okay, right, well, this is the truth. Well, that doesn't feel very nice. And we don't really want that to be our truth. But actually, we're going to be courageous and confront it and deal with it and try and make it better.
Yeah. I think courage can come from different places, can't it? So I think there's a link, isn't there, between courage and belief as well? Because if you really, truly believe in something, it's easier to muster up that courage. But I also think this goes back to one of the most ultimate privileges of all time. And I do believe in things like white privilege, male privilege. I do believe they are real things. I know some people don't, but I do believe that they exist and I benefit from both of those. But I think one of the things that the ultimate privilege is one parent or guardian, it doesn't have to be, but just one single parent or someone when you're younger that instills a level of belief that you have worth.
Yeah.
Because I think that is a foundation where I remember in my first job, we went out for dinner and I was with my manager. And he's been really horrible to the waitress. And I said, why are you being really horrible to her? And he basically said, it's like you can feel this power, can't you, Matt? And I was like, what? And I remember just instinctively knowing that this guy was a wrong one. But I also reflect on the fact that I probably knew that because of my parents. And I had seen and watched them be in business and observed them. And I'd learned the way that they operated. But I've also reflected on it. What if I didn't have that privilege of parents to watch and model? He may have become an influential person in my life that may have made me think that that was the way to operate. Until 20 years later, I turn up at Natasha Wallace and she's coaching me and we dig it all out. So I think a lot of this does go back. And I think in childhood, like you do need someone that puts in that self-worth and belief. And I coach children, so I see it every single day. And as a football coach.
So I think there's a link between courage, belief, but also what's coded into your values as a youngster as well.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, courage can come from total adversity in childhood too. But that is another podcast. Thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today, Matt. If people would like to find out more about you, what you do, what's the best thing for them to do to find you?
Well, I'm just going to leave everyone with one quote on peace, which is a quote by Leo Tolstoy. I can't even say his name, but I'm pretty sure most people know who he is. Which is a quote which people, I think, is misunderstood a lot, and I think it links to peace, which is, if you want to be happy, be. That's all the quote is. And some people don't like that quote because they read it as, if you want to be happy, be happy. But I don't think that's what he meant. Nobody knows what he meant. But if he'd have meant happy, he would have wrote happy at the end. That's the way I look at it. And that for me, that is the link to peace. If you want to be happy, be. And for me, that is all the stuff that we know about, like living in the moment, and that we've learned through different things now. But I just wanted everyone to leave everyone on that point, linking happiness and peace. I think that is the quote that links the two. And if you want to work with the Happiness Index, go to thehappinessindex.com. If you want to work with me as a speaker, go to mattphelan.co.uk. If you just want to have a chat, add me on LinkedIn and send me a message. But yeah, simple as that.
Great. Thank you so much. Really, really great speaking to you today. Thanks, Matt.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to Peace is a Choice. For any information on what we've covered in today's episode and to connect with my guests, head to the show notes. It would be great if you could rate and review the podcast and subscribe now so you don't miss out on any future episodes.